Chapter 18. The days drifted by, and they grew ever more dreary. For Barrow's efforts to find work for Tracy were unavailing. Always the first question asked was, "What union do you belong to?" Tracy was obliged to reply that he didn't belong to any trade union. "Very well, then, it's impossible to employ you. My men wouldn't stay with me if I should employ a scab, apostrophe a rat, or whatever the phrase was." Finally, Tracy had a happy thought. He said, "Why, the thing for me to do, of course, is to join a trade union." "Yes," Barrow said, "that is the thing for you to do if you can." "If I can? Is it difficult?" "Well, yes," Barrow said, "it's sometimes difficult, in fact, very difficult. But you can try, and of course it will be best to try." Therefore Tracy tried, but he did not succeed. He was refused admission with a good deal of promptness, and was advised to go back home, where he belonged, not come here taking honest men's bread out of their mouths. Tracy began to realize that the situation was desperate, and the thought made him cold to the marrow. He said to himself, "So there is an aristocracy of position here, and an aristocracy of prosperity, and apparently there is also an aristocracy of the ins as opposed to the outs, and I am with the outs. So the ranks grow daily, here. Plainly there are all kinds of castes here and only one that I belong to, the outcasts." But he couldn't even smile at his small joke, although he was obliged to confess that he had a rather good opinion of it. He was feeling so defeated and miserable by this time that he could no longer look with philosophical complacency on the horseplay of the young fellows in the upper rooms at night. At first it had been pleasant to see them unbend, and have a good time after having so well earned it by the labors of the day, but now it all rasped upon his feelings and his dignity. He lost patience with the spectacle. When they were feeling good, they shouted, they scuffled, they sang songs, they romped about the place like cattle, and they generally wound up with a pillow fight, in which they banged each other over the head, and threw the pillows in all directions, and every now and then he got a buffet himself, and they were always inviting him to join in. They called him Oni Bull, and invited him with excessive familiarity to take a hand. At first he had endured all this with good nature, but latterly he had shown by his manner that it was distinctly distasteful to him, and very soon he saw a change in the manner of these young people toward him. They were souring on him as they would have expressed it in their language. He had never been what might be called popular. That was hardly the phrase for it. He had merely been liked, but now dislike for him was growing. His case was not helped by the fact that he was out of luck, couldn't get work, didn't belong to a union, and couldn't gain admission to one. He got a good many slights of that small ill-defined sort that you can't quite put your finger on, and it was manifest that there was only one thing which protected him from open insult, and that was his muscle. These young people had seen him exercising, mornings, after his cold sponge bath, and they had perceived by his performance, and the build of his body, that he was athletic, and also versed in boxing. He felt pretty naked now, recognizing that he was shorn of all respect except respect for his fists. One night when he entered his room he found about a dozen of the young fellows there carrying on a very lively conversation punctuated with hoarse laughter. The talking ceased instantly, and the frank affront of a dead silence followed. He said, "Good evening, gentlemen," and sat down. There was no response. He flushed to the temples, but forced himself to maintain silence. He sat there in this uncomfortable stillness some time, then got up and went out. The moment he had disappeared he heard a prodigious shout of laughter break forth. He saw that their plain purpose had been to insult him. He ascended to the flat roof, hoping to be able to cool down his spirit there, and get back his tranquility. He found the young tinner up there, alone and brooding, and entered into conversation with him. they were pretty fairly matched now, in unpopularity and general ill luck and misery, and they had no trouble in meeting upon this common ground with advantage, and something of comfort to both. But Tracy's movements had been watched, and in a few minutes the tormentors came straggling one after another to the roof, where they began to stroll up and down in an apparently purposeless way. But presently they fell to dropping remarks that were evidently aimed at Tracy, and some of them at the tinner. The ringleader of this little mob was a short-haired bully and amateur prize fighter named Allen, who was accustomed to lording it over the upper floor, and had more than once shown a disposition to make trouble with Tracy. Now there was an occasional catcall, and hootings, and whistlings, and finally the diversion of an exchange of connected remarks was introduced. How many does it take to make a pair? Well, two generally makes a pair, but sometimes there ain't stuff enough in them to make a whole pair. General laugh. What were you saying about the English a while ago?
Oh, nothing, the English are all right, only what was it you said about them?
Oh, I only said they swallow well.
Swallow better than other people?
Oh, yes, the English swallow a good deal better than other people.
What is it they swallow best?
Oh, insults. Another general laugh.
Pretty hard to make 'em fight, ain't it?
No, tain't hard to make 'em fight.
Ain't it, really?
No, tain't hard. It's impossible.
Another laugh.
This one's kind of spiritless, that's certain.
Couldn't be the other way in his case.
Why?
Don't you know the secret of his birth?
No, has he got a secret of his birth?
You bet he has.
What is it?
His father was a wax figure.
Allen came strolling by where the pair were sitting, stopped, and said to the tinner,
How are you off for friends, these days?
Well enough off.
Got a good many?
Well, as many as I need.
A friend is valuable, sometimes as a protector, you know.
What do you reckon would happen if I was to snatch your cap off and slap you in the face with it?
Please don't trouble me, Mr. Allen, I ain't doing anything to you.
You answer me. What do you reckon would happen?
Well, I don't know.
Tracy spoke up with a good deal of deliberation and said,
Don't trouble the young fellow, I can tell you what would happen.
Oh, you can you?
Boys, Johnny Bull can tell us what would happen if I was to snatch this chump's cap off and slap him in the face with it.
Now you'll see. He snatched the cap and struck the youth in the face, and before he could inquire what was going to happen, it had already happened, and he was warming the tin with the broad of his back. Instantly there was a rush, and shouts of,
a ring, make a ring.
Fair play all round.
Johnny's grit. Give him a chance.
The ring was quickly chalked on the tin, and Tracy found himself as eager to begin as he could have been if his antagonist had been a prince instead of a mechanic. At bottom he was a little surprised at this, because although his theories had been all in that direction for some time, he was not prepared to find himself actually eager to measure strength with quite so common a man as this ruffian. In a moment all the windows in the neighborhood were filled with people, and the roofs also. The men squared off, and the fight began. But Allen stood no chance whatever against the young Englishman. Neither in muscle nor in science was he his equal. He measured his length on the tee in time and again. In fact, as fast as he could get up he went down again, and the applause was kept up in liberal fashion from all the neighborhood around. Finally, Allen had to be helped up. Then Tracy declined to punish him further, and the fight was at an end. Allen was carried off by some of his friends, in a very much humbled condition, his face black and blue and bleeding, and Tracy was at once surrounded by the young fellows, who congratulated him, and told him that he had done the whole house a service, and that from this out Mr. Allen would be a little more particular about how he handled slights and insults, and maltreatment around amongst the boarders. Tracy was a hero now, and exceedingly popular. Perhaps nobody had ever been quite so popular on that upper floor before.
But if being discountenanced by these young fellows had been hard to bear, their lavish commendations and approval and hero worship was harder still to endure. He felt degraded, but he did not allow himself to analyze the reasons why, too closely. He was content to satisfy himself with the suggestion that he looked upon himself as degraded by the public spectacle which he had made of himself, fighting on a tin roof, for the delectation of everybody a block or two around. But he wasn't entirely satisfied with that explanation of it. Once he went a little too far, and wrote in his diary that his case was worse than that of the prodigal son. He said the prodigal son merely fed swine, he didn't have to chum with them. But he struck that out, and said, "All men are equal. I will not disown my principles. These men are as good as I am." Tracy was become popular on the lower floors also. Everybody was grateful for Alan's reduction to the ranks, and for his transformation from a doer of outrages to a mere threatener of them. The young girls, of whom there were half a dozen, showed many attentions to Tracy, particularly that boarding house pet Hattie, the landlady's daughter. She said to him, very sweetly, "I think you're ever so nice." And when he said, "I'm glad you think so, Miss Hattie," she said, still more sweetly, "Don't call me Miss Hattie, call me Puss." Ah, here was promotion. He had struck the summit. There were no higher heights to climb in that boarding house. His popularity was complete. In the presence of people, Tracy showed a tranquil outside, but his heart was being eaten out of him by distress and despair. In a little while he should be out of money, and then what should he do? He wished, now, that he had borrowed a little more liberally from that stranger's store. He found it impossible to sleep. A single torturing, terrifying thought went racking round and round in his head, wearing a groove in his brain. What should he do? What was to become of him? And along with it began to intrude a something presently which was very like a wish that he had not joined the great and noble ranks of martyrdom, but had stayed at home and been content to be merely an earl and nothing better, with nothing more to do in this world of a useful sort than an earl finds to do. But he smothered that part of his thought as well as he could. He made every effort to drive it away, and with fair keep it from intruding a little success, but he couldn't now and then, and when it intruded it came suddenly, and nipped him like a bite, a sting, a burn. He recognized that thought by the peculiar sharpness of its pang. The others were painful enough, but that one cut to the quick when it came. Night after night he lay tossing to the music of the hideous snoring of the honest breadwinners until 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning, then got up, and took refuge on the roof, where he sometimes got a nap and sometimes failed entirely. His appetite was leaving him, and the zest of life was going along with it. Finally, O'Day, being near the imminent verge of total discouragement, he said to himself, and took occasion to blush privately when he said it, "If my father knew what my American name is, my duty to my father rather requires that I furnish him my name. I have no right to make his days and nights unhappy. I can do enough unhappiness for the family all by myself. Really, he ought to know what my American name is." He thought over it a while, and framed a cablegram in his mind to this effect. "My American name is Howard Tracy." That wouldn't be suggesting anything. His father could understand that as he chose, and doubtless he would understand it as it was meant, as a dutiful and affectionate desire on the part of a son, to make his old father happy for a moment. Continuing his train of thought, Tracy said to himself, "Ah, but if he should cable me to come home, I couldn't do that. I mustn't do that. I've started out on a mission, and I mustn't turn my back on it in cowardice. No, I couldn't go home, at least I shouldn't want to go home." After a reflective pause, maybe, perhaps, it would be my duty to go in the circumstances. He's very old, and he does need me by him to stay his footsteps down the long hill that inclines westward toward the sunset of his life. Well, I'll think about that. Yes, of course it wouldn't be right to stay here. If I well, perhaps I could just drop him a line, and put it off a little while, and satisfy him in that way. It would be well, it would mar everything to have him require me to come instantly. Another reflective pause, then colon and, yet if he should do, that I don't know but oh, dear me home, how good it sounds. And a body is excusable for wanting to see his home again, now, and then, anyway. He went to one of the telegraph offices in the avenue, and got the first end of what Barrow called the Sewell Washington courtesy, where they treat you as a tramp until they find out you're a congressman, and then they slobber all over you. There was a boy of 17 on duty there, tying his shoe. He had his foot on a chair, and his back turned towards the wicket. He glanced over his shoulder, took Tracy's measure, turned back, and went on tying his shoe. Tracy finished writing his telegram and waited, and still waited, for that performance to finish, but there didn't seem to be any finish to it. So finally Tracy said, "Can't you take my telegram?" The youth looked over his shoulder and said, by his manner, not his words, "Don't you think you could wait a minute, if you tried?" However, he got the shoe tied at last, and came and took the telegram, glanced over it, then looked up surprised, at Tracy. There was something in his look, that bordered upon respect, almost reverence, it seemed to Tracy, although he had been so long without anything of this kind he was not sure, that he knew the signs of it. The boy read the address aloud, with pleased expression in face and Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.